51 years ago this month, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed while standing on the upper balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. 51 years. It's hard to believe. In more recent years, the National Civil Rights Museum has been constructed within that site, preserving that Green Book Motel where African-American artists and musicians and speakers like Dr. King stayed during their visits to Memphis. Now, I remember the first time I turned the corner of Mulberry and Calhoun Street in that city and saw the motel, and I was struck by a wave of unanticipated emotion. The facade of the motel remains much as it was in 1968, though its interior is now a winding labyrinth of exhibits, everything from a lunch counter from Greensboro's Woolworths to an actual Montgomery City bus, a holding cell from the Birmingham City Jail, and a burned-out shell of a Greyhound bus that once carried freedom riders. The walk through the museum is a stirring, troubling journey back in time, recounting with unmistakable power the tumult, the triumph, the determination, the deep shame of those days in our national life. The penultimate stop along the winding exhibit provides an audio recording of a now famous speech by Dr. King delivered in support of striking sanitation workers in Memphis at the Mason Temple Church. It was delivered the night before he died. It was there that he shared a vision for America, there that he concluded with what is now his second most frequently quoted speech. That final night, thinking of Moses on top of Mount Pisgah, Dr. King spoke of having been to the mountaintop. "Like anybody," he said, "I would love to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And God's allowed me to go up the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Standing in the corridor of that museum, one cannot hear those haunting words without being stirred by their prophetic power once again. And then the museum visitor turns and moves to the emotional climax of the tour, a viewing area that looks into room 306, where Dr. King had spent his final night, where he and his friends had shared a final meal of catfish. A written chronology of the events, those final hours, concludes the tour, leading one to a window with a close-range view of the balcony on which he was shot, the spot now marked by a cut square on the concrete floor. Almost inevitably, one leaves that area humming the tune that's playing continuously in the background. It is Mahalia Jackson singing, and it's Dr. King's favorite hymn, Thomas Dorsey's Precious Lord, Take My Hand. If you're ever in Memphis, that museum is a must, but it will not leave you unmoved, unaffected, or, as in my case, unindicted. Thoughts of Dr. King in that museum and of Palm Sunday bring back so many memories, not only of his life and death, but of the days that followed that killing. In 1968, as an undergraduate student thinking about seminary, I had agreed, along with a friend, to spend a season of preaching in a small church, two small churches in rural North Carolina, not too far from the college where I was attending. I don't know what they were thinking when they invited two college students to preach, but we did. Our compensation was meager, though surely more than we were worth as preachers. But each Sunday, members of the church endured our attempts and then took turns inviting us to lunch at their farm tables, which was the best compensation of all. That Sunday, After Dr. King's death, it was my turn to preach. It was Palm Sunday, just like today. And that day, trying to be sensitive to the environment of those congregations, yet feeling the need to address our national crisis in some way, I offered an embarrassingly poor little homily on reconciliation. To my memory, I don't know that I even mentioned Dr. King by name, but I suppose the intent was transparent. At the first church, things seemingly went pretty well, but at the second, I'd only been speaking for a few moments when, out of the corner of my eye over here on the left, I noticed a couple get up and leave. They were followed a moment later by another elderly man and then another couple on the other side, and in the space of the next minute and a half, I suppose, the entire congregation of about 35 people got up and walked out. Only the organist, my friend Frank, and I were left. I decided it might be a good time to stop preaching. I looked at the organist and I asked what had just happened. And he said, politely, "Folks here never thought much of Dr. Martin Luther King." Needless to say, we didn't get invited to lunch on Palm Sunday of 1968. Given the volatility of the South in those days and what we later learned about the entrenchment of the Ku Klux Klan in that county, I suppose we were somewhat fortunate to get out of town alive. Not a Palm Sunday goes by that I don't remember that day. Not one. And more importantly, not a Palm Sunday goes by that I don't remember the torment of the nation in those days, the anguish of so many that Martin King was so soon gone and dead. Ironically, though King was clearly at the head of the civil rights movement, he was not always there by choice. And his preaching in the last months of his life revealed something of the inner turmoil about the way things were wrapped up in his leadership. One of the most revealing moments of that struggle came during a sermon he preached in Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church 2 months before his death. The sermon was aimed at the American role in the Vietnam War, of which Dr. King was critical, but another part of that sermon was intensely personal. He spoke that Sunday on the theme, the drum major instinct. And his text was the story from Mark's gospel in which James and John asked Jesus for the privilege of sitting on his right hand and his left in glory. Drawing on that story and the insight of white Methodist preacher J. Wallace Hamilton and psychoanalyst Alfred Adler, King spoke about the human impulse to want to be at the head of the parade, to lead others, to achieve distinction. All of us, said Dr. King in that sermon, want to be important. And he illustrated that point by citing a piece of mail he had just received that week. "I got a letter the other day," he said. "It was about a new magazine coming out, and it opened up, 'Dear Dr. King, as you know, you are on many mailing lists, and you are categorized as highly intelligent, progressive, a lover of the arts and sciences, and I know you'll want to read what I have to say.' Well, of course I did," King said, "after you just said all of that and explained me so exactly. Of course I wanted to read it." That not-so-subtle marketing ploy underscored a more serious tendency, though, to play up our own self-importance. "And it leads," he said, "ultimately to unbridled arrogance that pushes others down in order to gain an upper hand." Dr. King went on to warn that the personal obsession with superiority was becoming a national obsession, too, and he warned of its consequences. They were prophetic words then. They are prophetic words now. "In contrast to such a drum major instinct," Dr. King said, "Jesus stood forth with a different plan. In response to James and John, Jesus didn't say their question was out of line. He did something altogether different. He redefined greatness." Again, Dr. King. And you know how he said it. He said, "Now, brothers, I can't give you greatness. And really, I can't make you first." This is what Jesus said to James and John. You must earn it. The greatness comes, true greatness comes not by favoritism, but by fitness. And so Jesus gave them a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But know this, that the one who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's your new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing I like about it, said King, is it means everybody can be great because everybody can serve. This morning, you can be on the right hand and the left hand of Jesus if you serve. It's the only way in. The day when Jesus came into Jerusalem, the people hailed him as king. As he rode a humble colt into the city, the people laid their cloaks and palms and leafy branches on the ground. The ultimate drum major in the ultimate parade, and yet, ironically, no drum major at all. Not at all. Rather, Jesus came then, as he comes now, as the one who would redefine greatness in terms of sacrifice and servanthood. It was a moment of profound irony. This one who was the king riding on to die, one who was the Son of God coming to live his life and give his life in willing sacrifice. Later in the week, he would come face to face with the drum majors in the praetorium, in the council of the chief priests and the scribes, in the presence of Pontius Pilate. And in that moment, two options would clearly present themselves for all to see. On the one hand was the love of power, which had systematically gathered all the hopes and fears of all the years and the lives of ordinarily well-meaning people into a hostile group crawling for crucifixion. And on the other hand, there was the power of love, which could not be tempted, even by the promise of ultimate victory, to turn that equation around. The drum major's love of power, face to face with the servant's power of love. The fact remains that despite the crowd's exuberance, despite the hosannas and the palms, Jesus rode into Jerusalem to meet his death. Even the stones knew, he told them. And despite all the hoopla of the parade, Jesus was too keenly aware of what awaited him to be distracted. Later in the week, he would meet his death sentence with the practiced calm of a servant. Note that Jesus doesn't lash out at his accusers. He doesn't seek to control a situation which one could argue was within his power to control. He controls only by yielding to God. Instead of saving himself, he will save another. Instead of harboring anger, he will exemplify mercy. A pastor friend says, "Our culture's love affair with success and power makes it hard to hear and understand that Jesus quietly goes through the drama of divine deliverance, yielding to the will of God. Jesus, fruitful in his obedience to God, doesn't show any sign of interest in the success scene. Instead of hail the conquering hero, this Palm Sunday we celebrate the humility and the vulnerability of Christ, who rode into Jerusalem to die and to conquer death for us. On this Palm Sunday, we remember the power of his passion, a power made manifest in weakness and vulnerability. And we who would follow him in our own time would do well to follow after his manner of humble service. You can be on the right or the left hand of Jesus, said Martin Luther King, but not as a drum major. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, it's wonderful. But understand that the one who is greatest among you will be your servant. The good thing is that such a redefinition of greatness means that everyone can be great, because everyone can serve. It's the only way to follow him. It's really the only way to be in his parade.